Okay. So the first thing I gave you was a series of articles by Dr. Avraham Steinberg. So we should put in the disclaimer before everything. Not only some of you, perhaps significant numbers of you know more than I do already, not just in general, but about this subject, but almost everybody we read certainly knows more than I do, both in Torah and on the substance of this subject. And so we need to put the disclaimer up front so that we can be harshly critical of them from now on without any fear of offense. I want to say up front, the Encyclopedia Hilchatit Rifuit, the Encyclopedia Medical Halakha, is an amazing accomplishment. Right? It creates order out of chaos. At the same time, I'm going to argue that it presents halakha in a particular way, which I will try to take strong issue with, and we'll see over the course of the 5 weeks how successfully I take issues about that. So I want to begin by going through his presentation on the assumption that it's a very, very good presentation of a particular vision of halakha, not just on this topic, but in general, and see, right, and try and point out what it is he's doing, and then where there might be space to envision the entire thing differently, and then take the specific article here as a case example of how to study, right, of how to study works like this, and then I'll try, and this is the only, perhaps, in original content that I'll put into this year, is try and set up a specific theory about how the halakha on this area as he presents it develops. Okay, the theoretical mode of shir is highly participatory. However, this is highly participatory shirim is not something that I can create myself. So it requires you to actually participate in order for that to happen. I do, however, feel authorized to call on you whenever I so please to read and or to right and to respond to questions. So please react favorably and well to that. If you have a particular objection to that, you should tell me that privately. But other than that, the idea generally is that you should walk into Shir in terror that you'll be called on for everything, so that you'll be really well prepared. Okay. So let's start with informed consent and how Dr. Steinberg presents it. So we'll start with you, Roy. Because you're right. So what does he tell us about informed consent?
First, he gives the background of what informed consent is. General medical ethics.
Good. So when did it start?
In 1957.
That's what he said. Okay, it starts in 1957. Dr. Applebaum will qualify that for you significantly, I assume. There's a much longer history. And you always have to deal with the question, when he says informed consent begins in 1957, does that mean the concept or the term?
Right.
Right, it's always an important issue. I'll give you this contemporary example. There are many... Right, there are many articles nowadays which are written claiming that the Das Torah begins in the early 20th century. And it is true the term Das Torah, as conventionally used, nowadays begins being used that way in the 20th century. That doesn't necessarily relate to the question of the extra halachic authority of rabbis, right, which may have existed long before that under a different term. For example, Menach Chachamim, or something like that. Right, so you have to be careful. So informed consent, the category as we have it, but he wants to argue, begins with a particular case in America in 1957. And what happened before then?
Before then, people were either these general practitioner physicians that, you know, knew the family well, and they could make decisions based on cultural or religious values that, you know, the doctor felt this family also had.
Aha. Okay, so now you're moving across. So before then, before informed consent, what was the basic principle?
The doctor would do whatever was necessary.
The doctor would do whatever was necessary.
Right.
So let's take a sort of extreme case. Right? I walk down the street, doctor sees me and says, that patient has a cold. Right? And you know, so it proceeds to shove whatever cold remedy they want down my throat. Right? Make sure, right? Does that work?
Well, no, I don't think everybody's talking about it. Right. Everybody mentions that there seems to be a patient-physician relationship that exists with physicians that were more acquainted he talks about the different modes of medicine that there are now versus what there was then.
Uh-huh.
So now we have various specialists that work in the hospital but don't really know anybody.
What's his second? What's the ethical principle he sees it as? Well, he has the term, the ethical principle that preceded informed consent. Paternalism.
Paternalism, right.
All right. So paternalism, right, which is, right, how would you define paternalism?
Basically, the doctors know better than you do.
Doctors know better than you do. Okay, so that's a very important line. Before informed consent, there was a notion that doctors know better than you do, and because doctors know better than you do, yeah?
Oh, no, sorry, the question.
But because doctors know better than you do, therefore?
Therefore, they will make the right decision for you.
Therefore, they will make the right decision for you. And now, doctors don't know better than you do.
Well, no, now people are more informed. Now we got, with paternalism, he does mention this specific thing. I think that was important. The patient-physician relationship, which doesn't exist anymore. And so, you know, Professor Steinberg thinks that every decision was based purely on medicine. He mentions cultural and religious values, which doctors used to know. And nowadays, doctors are not familiar with each patient as much, so they don't really know. They won't be able to make those decisions as an appropriate manner as they used to.
So that's an interesting model. So if we were to set this up, so look up Sheila. Doctors should make all the decisions. But bidyevid, right, since we live in a world in which, right, regrettably the doctor-patient relationship is broken down, it is necessary.
I don't know if it's bidyevid, because now we have these, there's two separate things. The Lechatchila version only has, you know, one general practitioner in every area, or whatnot, and so the general, you know, that person probably has less technical medical knowledge for every specialty. Whereas now your specialists were more technically aware, more technically knowledgeable.
Okay, so I should say ethically Lechatchila. Right, informed consent is not a lichatchila. Informed consent is a concession to the break, possibly salutary for other reasons, breakdown of the doctor-patient relationship.
The very lichatchila would be that every patient should really know everything, should really know, you know, be a doctor.
Uh-huh, okay, that's also a good answer. Okay, Rob, what did you want to ask?
Yeah, isn't there some, even under a paternalistic model, isn't there some amount of consent that's implied just by the act of going to visit the doctor?
Well, who says you went to go visit the doctor?
The doctor came to your house.
Are doctors just, you know, coming off the street, like, you know, coming into your house and seeing
you
when you're
the doctor?
Presumably, usually when one visits a doctor, one actually makes an effort to...
I don't know. It depends on the kind of, you know, certainly not on the battlefield.
Sometimes they had a house doctor.
Okay, so you say there's a difference between, say, emergency care versus...
Yeah. I also think that this notion of the GP is like a very, very culturally bounded... historically bounded notion. I mean, I don't know that was really like that. Most patients in the time of Chazal, for example, had a family doctor. That seems very unlikely to me. I don't know any record in the time of Chazal. You know, is there any record anywhere in rabbinic literature of I went to the family doctor who had taken care of me since I was a child? So I'm not at all sure that there's a
family doctor. That was just the only doctor within.
Yeah, there was only one doctor in your town, and that's who everyone went to.
And you had whom you had like a deep relationship with.
Yeah,
aha. Okay. You find it more culturally compelling than I do. I suspect, first of all, there were like lots of really poor people. Lots of really poor people probably had no relationship with doctors at all, except in extreme emergencies, just as nowadays. Right? You know, they might. Right.
But even in an extreme emergency, unless you're talking about some sort of battlefield situation where there's some other people bringing you to the doctor, presumably there's some amount of consent that's happening in the act of going to the doctor.
So, it's an interesting claim, right? There aren't so many cases of vigilante doctors wandering around, you know, but presumably all, you know, so let...
Good Samaritan
doctor, right? You know, just people who are wandering around. Yeah, I imagine there were people who wandered around injecting vaccines into people. Right, just for fun. Right, to say, there might still be people like that who wander around with syringes to do that. Okay, now, but is that now just so Roy? Is that the vision that he says that's what ought to happen? Is doctors ought to be wandering around?
I don't know if in this entire first section, reading his historical background, he mentions what ought to happen. He's mentioning what happened.
Uh-huh.
And now what there is now. They're trying to give you background before he gets into the issue of what is this informed consent? How did informed consent come out? I don't know if he's making a value judgment that this was better.
Okay. Elliot, what do you want to say?
It doesn't seem like the setup of Lukashkila, that general doctor knows patient-physician relationship is good, it's Lukashkila, and that's why, and informed consent is only for the Abbas. It doesn't seem that's the historical reasoning, because he talks about how the Noam child and how all the Nazi medical testing broke through a hole into the ethics of pugilism, and that it's also ethically questionable pugilism, and the informed consent is really what's better.
Okay, good. Okay, so that's excellent. So we're on page 138 of the original article right now. Right, so Elliot points out correctly that what he said, right, that in Dr. Steinberg's category, what you have is you start with this model of paternalism, and paternalism works on the premise that doctors have the patient's best interest at heart. Right, so paternalism works on the premise that all of us want the best decision to be made. Right, all other things being equal, we can assume the doctor will make a better decision than the patient, the doctor having more, right, having more medical information, having perhaps the capacity for objectivity that the patient doesn't. And what happens is that, Nuremberg comes along, among other things, and Nuremberg says, wow, sometimes doctors are evil. And there has to be some way to protect yourself against evil doctors, because you don't know if the guy's injecting you with a vaccine or with a disease. Okay? Sometimes, but the guy might be wandering around giving you the vaccine, or might be wandering to give you the disease, right? Right, or he might be, right, or he might be giving you a placebo, right? There has to be some control, because the only control in the paternalistic model is the virtue of doctors.
I mean, is that really true in the case of the Nazi doctors? Because they weren't claiming to have the Jewish interest in mind. They were saying, all right, we're experimenting on these Jews who we hold as having no value for the sake of the Germans. So actually, they weren't being unethical in their own twisted ethics.
Mm-hmm.
They weren't lying to anybody.
And so one of the things that we discover is that often doctors will actually, I use a Star Trek Next Generation episode for this. Right. That's your quote?
No, I'm just saying often doctors will have twisted ethics. The idea that you can say that within their own minds it was okay, the fact that everyone else...
No, but not just within their minds.
Internally
it was okay.
Does not mean
I'm not saying internally consistent. I'm saying they're still trustworthy because they weren't pretending to do
that. Oh, they weren't pretending to do otherwise. But what happens if a doctor is using you as a guinea pig because they think that, you know what, this might kill you, but if it saves you, it'll say, right, it'll... Right, then it has the potential of saving the next 50 people also.
Now, there's a difference if he's open about that or not.
It also doesn't have to even be all distressed. Like, you could just see that the doctor has his own, like, philosophies. If this type of medicine is generally the best way to deal with patients, even though there are a lot of other doctors that go by other methods.
Sure, so that's a medical uncertainty, right? That's what he brings in. That's another issue, right? Lack of confidence. But you're saying that he's being honest, but why does he have to tell you, who says he has to tell you anything? Maybe doctors should just be able to come up and inject you without telling you anything, so honesty doesn't even come up. Now, okay, we'll talk about, I'm sure Dr. Alban will talk about America not only has the Nuremberg thing, we also have America is haunted by the Tuskegee experiments, right, which were experiments which basically allowed a group of African Americans to be the control group for syphilis and not treat them, right, in order to find out the data, and there's actually a whole set of other experiments that matches. Tuskegee becomes the most famous. It also becomes a very important Captain America comic book. for those of you who read those, no, you don't read. All right, sorry, enough of my pop references. Yes, you read it too. Good, it's a great comic book. It really is the Captain America, the re-envisioned Captain America. Okay, so we have right. So informed consent develops. Right, and I'm comfortable setting this up as the initial framework. There's always a tension. All political theory models, right? Pardon?
Sorry, just it's not clear from the Steinberg article it might still be, as you said, informed consent might in 1957 maybe it was just a term, but it seems that in general patients consented to this paternalistic model. I consent to whatever the doctor. Just by my showing up at the doctor, consenting
sure.
to what the doctor is going to want.
Sure. But the doctor's the major difference is that the doctor's responsibility is to the patient's interest and not to the patient in the paternalistic model. Right. The doctor is not accountable to the patient for anything but results. Right. In a paternalistic model, you can still have malpractice suits. Right. After the fact, you can have malpractice suits. Right. You cut my leg off, and I still don't feel good. Right? Right? You can, right? Right? And we can talk about what the standards. Without what the standards are for malpractices. But this is, okay, so actually we still got, there are two kinds of issues that need to come up here. One is that you always have to figure out what's the model, what's the ideal model for having the best decision made? All right, and that often, and the, if you ask the question, what's the ideal model for having the best decision made? The answer will always be, have the most expert person make the decision. Right, that's a reasonable, right, if you read Plato, right, that's how philosophers always end up being the ones in charge. Right, because you ask, who knows the most about it? Well, philosophers know the most about everything, so philosophers should always end up making the decision. Right, philosophers know where to steer the boat, right, everyone else is largely useless. The problem is often raised with that is whom are these experts accountable to? Right. How do you have the right? How do you get the shomer who's me'al shomer? Right. If you have the philosopher kings, whatever your class of experts is, if you just give them power, then on what basis are they accountable? And if you have a somewhat more cynical political view, which is that with lack of accountability, people behave ethically worse than when they are accountable. Then it will turn out, right, because if we say that, you know what, I can make corrupt decisions, my doctor can make corrupt decisions, I am not likely less corrupt than my doctor knows more than I do, we still end up with my doctor making decisions. Even though I know that sometimes my doctor will make decisions that are ethically corrupt, so would I. What difference does it make? Right, but if we say that putting doctors in a position where they are not accountable for their decisions, means that they are more likely to make corrupt decisions, right? Than elsewhere, right? So then I lose the advantage of having better decisions made if I just give it over to an unaccountable class. Okay, now I'm presenting the theory this right. What's the obvious parallel to what I'm talking about in the world of Judaism? You, Jonathan, you got it. Right. You're smiling. You're right.
Well, I've heard from you.
Yeah. Right. Which is stop. Right? Same question, right? The best way for a halachic decision to be made is by halachic experts. Right? That's if you want the best, right? The best religious decision made should be made by the halachic experts, which are, right? But what happens if the, right? So we create a Moeses Gedolei HaTorah, right? Which makes the best possible decisions. And as long as we believe that their virtue is unquestionable, then we have the best, right? We have a paternalistic model.
But we have to believe their virtue is unquestionable because they constantly
right, and that's like saying, so that, right, we have to believe, right, and if the doctors declare that this was the best medical result, we're all set. There's often a delusion this way that, you know, that setting up standards within a profession actually solves the problem. For me, the best model of this was some years ago when we were passing legislation about cloning. Right, and so everyone raised all these ethical issues involved in human cloning, and the solution was, we'll set up a panel of scientists to set up an ethical panel, and that will solve all the ethical problems. No, that was the whole problem. So we didn't trust them. Right. I was setting up a panel, right, it's a real, so you end up, right, so this is fundamentally a democratic argument. Right, the democratic argument is not that, I think the better democratic argument, one democratic argument, which I think is probably excessively optimistic, is that you make better decisions when everyone is involved. There's some truth to that, but not so much. Right? But a different democratic argument is that accountability is necessary for decisions, and so it's better to have, let's say, political decisions made. You're looking at me kind of... Because you don't believe this at all?
Me?
No, Genesis. Okay. you can make a very plausible argument that it makes no sense to let people with no political or economic knowledge, right? Why do we have a democratic system in which we let people who can't add decide how to decide whether we should have a pro-growth policy or an austerity policy? Okay, right. You look at literacy tests. There are lots of people who are literate who can't add. Winston Churchill, for example.
Highly literate, but apparently,
by his own testimony, was not really capable of adding. This had unfortunate consequences in certain naval battles. Nonetheless, we tend to accept as a democratic model that the military tacticians and the economists should be accountable to us. Okay, and you can set that up as a principle, right? And that's as a principle for all types of decision making, that accountability to the people who are affected by the decision improves the nature of the decision making process. Okay, that's a response to the paternalistic model, and that, in large measure, that's what the Nuremberg argument is. Right, is that we simply don't trust doctors to police themselves. Yes, Philip? No? Okay. That is the second stage, and that's what Roy was focusing on, which is to argue that maybe medical decisions are predicated on factors that are non-medical, and doctors have no more capacity to address the non-medical questions than we do. That would tend to lead you towards a model, though, in which doctors should be bound by the ethical and cultural framework of the patient as the patient explains it to them. Given that medical framework, the doctor should still make the decision. In my culture, we prize mobility. We prize mobility over whatever the contrary thing is, right? Over dignity, whatever you want to call it. So once you explain that, the doctor says, okay, the best thing is this. So I'm not sure how far that as such gets you. Okay. Now he tells you that the model that informed consent, for whatever reason, has historically become, as a historical fact, we live in an age in which informed consent is a dominant paradigm. Right? If you live in the West, basically everyone has adopted informed consent as opposed to paternalism as the formal model for ethics. We'll talk about, as we bring in practitioners, we'll talk about whether having something as a formal model is actually a reflection of practice. That's the second stage issue. Yes, David?
I think it's clear, both in what you said about informed consent and as a general political theory that emerges from it, is that it's clear that all the models, the power ultimately rests with the people and with the individual. It's just a question of how much of their ultimate authority can we assume the stoma that they've handed over.
Why does paternalism assume that they have authority?
It's just, ultimately, I think even in the paternalistic system, if I know beferish that they object to my treatment, I can't give them that treatment.
Why not?
Because I have a right based on a cultural norm to assume that this is what the patient would want from me.
In the cultural model, right? I have a right to assume that. But again, it may not be that I have a right to assume that because I assume this patient agree. It might be that the culture authorizes me to make decisions in accordance with its cultural norms. And it's just that we live in a multicultural society, so we don't have cultural norms to impose on people.
The cultural norms which I'm participating in by virtue of being a part of that society.
Right, we might still have that in medicine, right? We could still have whatever the shared norms are in America, we could assume that. It just happens that in America, I don't know if it's necessarily because of doctor-patient relationships.
I don't think the nature of the doctor-patient relationship is the key thing. It's just a question of, at one time we were able to assume, absent all other factors, that the patient would trust the doctor without a lot of information being provided. We can't assume that now anymore. But it's still ultimately the patient's
decision. What you want to argue is that informed consent was always the principle. It just happened that paternalism allowed us to work function on the basis of an umdana. That we would have consent.
Yeah.
So it's not actually informed consent, it's that consent was always the model.
Yeah.
Right? And that informed is a new chiddush because we require that. Possible. We'll have to talk about whether that works. I don't think that's how paternalism works, but we'll see if we can I think paternalism assumed that the patient had not. Well, thought that Dr. Steinberg's vision of halacha doesn't work that way.
No, clearly not. I'm talking about how paternalism would have worked in a.
Okay, so you have to go over the theories and see how people understood it that way. Okay, I want to point out one other issue, which is that whenever you're trying to protect against errors, you can always make the decision to protect against them by creating repercussions for failure or by prior restraint. And that's a very important legal frame decision. Right? If I want to prevent bad things from happening, bad decisions from being made, do I do it by saying that if you get it wrong, you'll be punished? Or do I do it by saying that you can't do it until the following things happen? Okay, the case where this shows up most famously in American law is free speech. Right? Do we decide to control, right? Nobody wants speech to be so completely free. Most people don't want speech to be so completely free that I can say horrible, horrible things about you without consequences, which are untrue. Right? Most people don't think I should be able to publish newspaper articles in which I accuse Rachel of mass murder without consequences. Right?
That's only a civil offense, so it's not a criminal offense.
Sure.
We can't put you in jail for that.
Well, that's also a decision. What kind of consequences I want, financial, right? But most people agree there should be consequences for saying vicious things about Rachel which have no basis in fact. But the question whether I would, but I now, I, now let's suppose that we all have an interest in making sure that the fewest possible nasty things are said about, fewest possible false nasty things are said about Rachel as possible. So we have different models. One model is that we say that anybody can print whatever they want about Rachel, but for each falsehood, each falsehood is punishable by a fine of up to $1 million and 27 years in jail. Okay? Right? And we have a credible policy, which in fact, people are regularly convicted of such crimes, right, until such point as we've stamped out. Or we can say, everything anybody writes about Rachel Cadler has to be reviewed by Rachel Cadler before it's published. Right? That's a different model. The second model is probably much more effective in terms of preventing falsehoods about Rachel Cadler from being published. But it has costs. For example, right, I could then write truthfully at Rachel Cadler that Rachel Cadler spent her entire time protecting her image. Right? all she's doing all day is reading articles about herself. Right? Right, the more articles I write like that, the more true it becomes. So right, there are costs to right. There are costs to prior restraint. Always ends up, first of all, creating restrictive bureaucracies. Now it may be that we have to figure out, because Rachel Cadler may also wish, once we give her the power to filter all the things that are published about her, it is possible that Rachel Cadler will also seek to prevent me from publishing true things about her. And so the cost of a policy of prior restraint is that it may turn out that Rachel Cadler becomes an utterly unknown phenomenon in the public eye, because nothing went through, because she likes privacy. And we have lost all the valuable information about Rachel that could have been gained otherwise by being published. So all the, right, now the same issue is in terms of, right, so informed consent is a form of prior restraint. Okay, it's a way of saying that you can't do things to me, because there might be things that shouldn't be done to me that I can now stop, but it might also be that there are things that should be done to me that I can now stop. That's the risk. Right? You could set up an entirely different regime, which is to say that the goal is to have the best possible medical outcome to happen, and the way in which we prevent doctors from being malicious is that you can sue them afterwards. And we set up a malpractice regime that is sufficiently draconian that people are not likely to do things that harm patients.
We have both.
So now we have, interestingly enough, we have both in some ways, yeah, right? We have an all-practice regime which is challenging in some ways, and then we have an insurance scheme set up to thwart the all-practice regime, right? And right, all, right, and all, and right, and all sorts of interesting, interesting Rube Goldberg contraptions designed to get to this result of preventing doctors from doing bad things to people. Okay, so I want to point out, these are all questions that have to be addressed halakhically. Right? And so you can't answer the question of what is the halakhic vision without addressing that notion, right? You know, health health has to address the issue, does it prefer, right, does it prefer prior restraints or post facto deterrence? And it's also practically. It may be, for example, that in theory, right, let's suppose it might be that in theory, halakha is strongly in favor of a deterrence through consequences model as opposed to a prior restraint model. But what happens if you live in an environment in which, because of din de malchusa, you can't set up effective consequences? Now we have to ask ourselves, is the halachic system one, we say the halachic system doesn't believe in prior restraint, and halachic system does believe in consequences, well, so what? We can't do consequences nowadays. The halachic system doesn't believe in prior restraint. Or do we say, no, the halachic system believes that it's really valuable to protect patients against wrongs done by doctors. Therefore, in the absence of a capacity for consequences, halacha must naturally set up a system for prior restraint. Right? Those are both perfectly plausible readings of the precedent. Okay, but often people will argue, well, look, you know, since, right, so for example, if I were to take his model, right, so I might say that, well, you know what, halacha doesn't make any mention of informed consent prior, right, why? Because halacha assumes the society of a general practitioner, right, who knows the family mores and all, right, et cetera, et cetera. But nowadays, that we don't have that anymore, so halacha, of course, has to adapt the same way secular morality did. It has to adapt for an environment in which, right, which no longer is a doctor-patient relationship. Right, there are other ways of doing that halachically. I could argue, right, you know, a good formal way of constraining this is that in the time of Chazal, doctors were all honest people who always considered their patients' interests first, aside from Tov Shabarof and Legehenim and all that. We're going to leave that in the corner aside. We're going to set up that model. And nowadays, you know, Bavarotena Horabim Nitkatno Adoros, all right, and so nowadays we have to set up a system of accountability for doctors. The model for this is the halachic vision of Batei Din. The original halachic model for Batei Din, certainly in the area of Gittin, is Beit Din Batei Batei Din Lo Dakinan. Right, we don't hold Batei Din accountable for their actions. Right, this is what in American law is called full faith and credit. Right, every court has to function on the almost irrebuttable presumption of the good faith and competence of every other court. But by the Middle Ages already, you have people writing Shuvah in the Gaonic Tree, you have people writing Shuvah and saying that was then. But we know nowadays all our Batei Din are corrupt, so, right, and incompetent. Right, it would be negligence for any Beit Din to accept another Beit Din yet without investigation. Right, so we might argue perfectly plausibly in halakha exactly the same thing. We could accept all the data. We could concede that the halakhic model as set up by all precedent prior to the development of the HMO is one that makes informed consent irrelevant, and nonetheless comes to the conclusion that informed consent is absolutely critical halakhically now. Okay, so I want to set that out up front. So we ask the question. Now, the underlying question that we'll raise, which we'll have to talk about at length, is what does it mean to say halakha requires when halakha has not formally said anything about this? All halakha has said is this is the desirable goal. Right? Is it reasonable to make the claim this is what halakha requires when halakha has only legislated an end and said nothing whatsoever about the means? Okay, or does that require legislation as opposed to judicial interpretation, and we don't believe in the capacity for legislation anymore? Okay, that's a broad question which shows up in many, many areas of medical halakha. Okay, so let's move on now to Dr. Steinberg's presentation of the contrast between informed consent and halakha. Okay, so Tal. So what is he, right, when he presents it, right, so he sets it up, there are two bases for informed consent, other than the ones I set up, right, they're both different than the ones I set up, and halakha doesn't believe in either of them. So How does he do that? We're on page 139. Pardon?
I had actually taken notes on this and gotten rid of them in the process as they became irrelevant.
From now on, we're just going to ask you to run all your decisions to dump your notes by me. Because they were relevant to me.
I don't recall offhand if you might go.
We can try someone else. Volunteer? We can try volunteers this time. Volunteers. Okay, Mike, try it.
So it's based around autonomy, meaning a person, the ideal situation is for a person to be choosing his own future and decisions and anything relating to his pertinent situations, and also ownership over the body, both of which he rejects.
Okay, good. Right, so the two, right, autonomy and ownership of your body. Right, and you think those are the philosophic bases for informed consent as opposed to the more pragmatic bases that he set up in the previous paragraph and right, and that I argued for. And then he says that, right, I think he has very, very wonderfully stark language, right, which he says that, where are we now? Right. The autonomy is the fundamental principle, however, according to halakha, this concept in halakha is limited. And the second one, right, that's on page 147. And then the other fundamental principle is ownership rights over one's body, and this principle is also not generally accepted in halakha. But I think in the encyclopedia article, he's actually even much starker. I think he just uses the term limited. Okay. So let's take the first article. The first one is really straightforward. So again, define autonomy again, Mish.
The ideal human situation being that of an individual choosing and defining his or her own destiny.
Okay, that's a cool definition. Ideal human situation is that of a human being choosing his or her own destiny. And halakha doesn't accept this because?
Several reasons. One being a limited sense of the individual in general. You know, the ideal of a person's, you know, first of all, the Torah chooses a person's path, and then a Rav chooses a person's path. And also that person has more the community's interest than his own interest at heart. And
Well, does he put that one in?
That last one, I don't think so.
I don't think he, let's skip that one for now, because he's not in there yet. In fact, let's say, he says, so that if the Torah and the Rav choose your path, right, that's the way you frame it. So the value of autonomy is, right, the value of autonomy is expressed as one which is unconstrained autonomy. Right, autonomy means that people can choose whatever they want, and as long as they want it, that's okay. So anybody who believes in right and wrong doesn't believe in autonomy.
Correct.
Well,
yeah.
Yeah, I mean, is that the argument he's making?
Does not believe in unrestricted autonomy, sure.
Well,
unless you autonomously decide what's right and what's wrong.
No. I believe in right and wrong. Because I believe in right and wrong, does that therefore mean that I don't believe that you have autonomy?
What does that mean if you believe in right or wrong?
Can you choose to do wrong anyway?
Sure. I think that it would be right for you to choose to become a great pianist, and it would be wrong for you to be somebody who wanders around just taking your fingernails and scratching them on blackboards all over the world. Right? I think that would be bad. Okay, does that mean that I don't believe that you have autonomy to choose whether to become a concert pianist or a blackboard scratcher?
No, I still have autonomy.
No, right? I don't, right?
What?
I think you have the autonomy. I think you have, right,
yeah.
Daniel's right. You have the autonomous. I think you have the autonomous choice between good and evil.
I'm a little confused. What's the, knockdown between autonomy and the right to one's own body as he's setting it up? I'm not...
We'll get there.
Okay.
Let's take in the first one, right? Because let's stay within autonomy. So right, we should read it inside, because I don't want to be unfair, right? He says that, right, we're on page 147. Autonomy is the fundamental principle upon which the 147 in the article. Autonomy is the fundamental principle upon which the concept of informed consent is based. However, the validity of this concept in halakha is limited. According to halakha, the physician is obligated to heal, and the patient is obligated to seek healing. Therefore, according to halakha, the medical treatment is often not determined by the desire and consent of the patient, but by the objective facts. So let's follow the argument through. Yes, David, what do you want to say?
I mean, we have to distinguish, of course, between legal autonomy and moral autonomy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
If I believe in right and wrong, I can still believe in autonomy as a legal principle, and I don't think the government or the court should be forcing you to make the right decision. You have that right to make the wrong decision, but as a moral principle, there's no way I can believe in autonomy, because when I, as your physician, am being asked to aid your autonomous decision to do something that I view as wrong, there's no way I can morally help you.
Okay. Jonathan, what do you want to say?
I mean, to be fair, he's assuming that there's no legal autonomy. He is either not in this article, in the other article where he starts comparing it, right? He gets into the question of Bez and Copen on this what I said.
Good.
Okay. Clear that he the issue at hand for him is legal autonomy, which is not actually this way.
No, I agree. He's
okay, good. So let's frame, right?
You can't agree that moral autonomy, you can't legislate, but that's why he's skipping that and just moving straight to legal autonomy and saying there's no such thing and prove it's sincere.
I agree
right
that there may not even be legal autonomy in the halakhic system, but it's been a long time since we've had a vacant power of Kofin al-Hamitzvot.
Which is why he then goes on to explain why that theoretical model is extended beyond the existence of Bezdin, which is what he's attempting to do. I mean, that he recognizes that problem, he just skips moral autonomy.
Okay, good. So let's watch.
Bezdin can also beat me up to give him a spilling on. But
we'll talk about that. Good. Let's watch this move. Okay. So let's write. So let's what you're both getting right entirely accurately is the move from halakha. Right. The move from halakha believes the patient has an obligation to seek healing and the physician has an obligation to heal. Right. And that can contrast with autonomy. That move doesn't work at all. Right. Because that's no different than saying right. That's no different than saying any principle of right and wrong conflicts with autonomy. Right, the move you have to make is that halakha, right? That halakha believes that the patient has an obligation to seek healing, and that we can enforce that obligation on the patient. Right, halakha believes that the physician has an obligation to heal, and we can enforce that obligation on the physician. If you make those two moves, right, that these halakhic obligations are enforceable, right, then you have a contrast with autonomy. Right, autonomy in the sense that I have the right to make decisions as opposed to having you make decisions for me. Not autonomy in the sense that the only thing that matters is that I made the decision. Okay, those are two very different conceptions of autonomy. Right? One conception of autonomy is that the fact of making the decision is what makes that I made the decision is what makes it right. Right? Authenticity in a sense is the criteria of value. And the other is autonomy is just that God gave me free will, I get to exercise it. Okay, there's a much, much, much deeper philosophic conversation that can be had there. But at least at first level, we need to introduce that. And by setting it up this way, right? So Jonathan is being charitable and saying, and he's assuming, of course, that we can compel you to do any mitzvah.
Can you repeat the two alternatives?
Okay, one possibility is, a really, really strong model of autonomy is that the primary value in all circumstances is that I make the decision that accords with me. And no matter what that decision is, that's the right decision. So that contradicts any notion of objective right and wrong, or of extra personal right and wrong, anything like that. Okay, that's a fundamental clash. And of course halakha contradicts that, but any system, right, any belief contradicts that, right, other than autonomy. Right? That's autonomy of the Leviathan, right? It follows up every other philosophic notion. A second notion is that, no, I think there's right and wrong, but I think that you ought to get to decide for yourself when to be right and when to do right and when to do wrong. I don't spend my time compelling you to make the decisions I think are right or I think are wrong, because as opposed to prior restraints, right, God made a decision. God made a decision as opposed to prior restraints to set up a system of consequences. Not only that, he chose to set the system of consequences largely up, right, with delayed consequences. Right, that's the decision. It doesn't seem to have worked terribly well in terms of promoting virtue, but apparently there are other goals that God had in mind. Right? Okay. So, right, so really, this is what I want to get at. Really, the question of whether halakha believes that there is an obligation to seek healing, an obligation to heal, is not related to the question of whether we have, of whether we believe in informed consent. Right, the only question that's related is whether we think halakha believes that we can coerce you to fulfill your obligation to seek healing. Right, that's a very different question. Right, so I'm not, we could talk about whether there is in fact an obligation to seek healing. Right, I'm not interested in that question this summer. Right, because it seems to me irrelevant, right? Except insofar as I could prove there was no obligation, then obviously we couldn't coerce you to fulfill it. Right, but I'm not going to try to make the argument. Yes?
I don't agree with that.
Okay.
Assessment.
Yeah?
Because if I, as a physician, have an independent obligation to heal, mm-hmm. whether or not I can coerce you to fulfill your obligation to seek healing is irrelevant.
Good. The question of whether the physician has an obligation to heal has consequences. The question of whether the patient has an obligation to be healed doesn't really, if it can't be coerced.
Yes, but he mentions both of them.
That's true. But anyway, the physician has an obligation to heal, may still impose an obligation on the physician to avoid informed consent in particular circumstances. Yes. Unless we have a counter value of autonomy. Right? Right. What we've said so far is that the patient's obligation to heal doesn't necessarily entitle coercion. We can make a stronger argument, which is that we start off with a premise of autonomy in halakha, and unless you can establish a right to coercion, we'll presume that there's no right to interfere. And that's not so, right. Whether halakha takes that position or not is an open question, and that's going to be very, very important. Right? Does the choice not to, right? In other words, you have three models. One model is, right, about any mitzvah. Okay, let's say the mitzvah of, what's a good mitzvah to say? Charity is a good model. Okay? Tzedakah. So I can say, right, I can choose to coerce you to give tzedakah. I can choose to say that, you know what? Halakha won't coerce you to give tzedakah. But if somebody comes in and takes all your stuff and gives it to tzedakah, that's fine. We don't interfere either way, right? Or I can say the model is that nobody has any right to interfere with your decision as to whether to give tzedakah or not. Right? Those are three different models, and I can set the same model up for patient healing. Right? One model is that we force you to be healed. The second model is that we don't force you to be healed, but we're not going to object if somebody heals you against your will. What, right? And the third obligation is no, they have no right to interfere with your decision as to whether to fulfill this mitzvah or not. Right? You have the right to decide whether to fulfill God's will in this matter or not, and anybody who interferes with that is perpetrating a tort against you. Okay, now, often people set up an either or, that the only choices halakha has are coercion or hands off, but maybe halakha actually thinks that there are times when it's wrong to force you. Right? Maybe the fact that we don't say, maybe whenever we don't allow kfiya, or at least in some circumstances where we don't allow kfiya, that's because we think that this should be left up to you. Right? I don't think anything, right, so in that model, nothing that he said, right, tells me, right, is against informed consent. The whole purpose, right, God gave us free will so we can make decisions in right and wrong. Here's another case of right and wrong. I shouldn't take away your free will. Right? Any more? Right? Yes, Jonathan.
And there's also just the right issue. Even if you assume that, the most extreme case of coercion, and that this would fall under the case of coercion, right? Nothing has been, right? Nothing's presented here to explain why that would allow you not to inform the person. I mean, even in the case of, right, a classic case of kfiya who doesn't take tzedakah, for example, but we don't start by being yoreid in kasa. We start by giving you the option. Right? We start by putting the facts on the table and letting you know what your obligation is and how you're supposed to fulfill that. If not, then we can force you. But he has not provided any evidence whatsoever, even in the most extreme model, that I could force you to do without you even knowing what you're doing.
Sure. Okay, good. Right. So we can talk about whether, right, just because in the end we would do without informed consent doesn't mean we shouldn't require informed consent up front. Right? That's also that's entirely true. Right? That the fact that in the end we would force you. Right? So let's take Gittin as the model. Right? The fact that in the end we are willing to resort to Kofino Soachioma Rotsani doesn't mean that the way we should start the court procedure is by beating you up. Right? It doesn't mean that, right? Persuasion works better for it. And there may be all sorts of good reasons for that. It may be that it's just because the long-term consequences are better if we don't beat you up. Or it might be because, you know what, sometimes really, sometimes we'll make better decisions about whom to coerce if we talk to you. Right? Maybe we'll discover there's another side of the case and it's better to listen to a person first. Right, yes, Tovia.
I think that even though the article says that it's about informed consent, I think that most of the article is really about the specific issue of what happens when the patient doesn't want to be healed. And that's where most of the sources seem to be going. So the issue that Jonathan raised, I think it's true that the person should be informed up front, and I don't think that you can find anything in Halakha to contradict that. The question is specifically in the case where the person doesn't give consent.
So let's assume that's true. Okay, let's assume that's true. But that's not something you would get when you read the article, and what you get is Halakha, right, doesn't accept the premises on which informed consent is based on. Whereas the way you would write it, you would say is that, right, if the article were to say what you want it to say, which I think is a very good argument, that's what the evidence in the article at best can say, is that halakha may or may not see extraordinary value in the process that currently takes place in the under the name of informed consent in American medical practice. And halakha may or may not believe that such procedures should be mandated in all medical procedures. However, halakha, like secular law, sometimes believes that in cases where information has been given and consent has been denied, right, with appropriate safeguards, medical treatment can nonetheless proceed. Now we can talk about whether those circumstances are different than they are in American law or not.
Right.
It's a very different article.
Yes.
Right. Because
but that's where all the evidence points. Though.
Yes. So that's exactly what I want to point out, is that you can present all the evidence absolutely fairly, and nonetheless you can set up a model, because if you reduce the question, right, you're exactly right, if you reduce the question of the relationship between halakha and informed consent to what happens in extreme cases, right, then you might be able to say halakha doesn't agree with informed consent, but probably you'll end up thinking that American law doesn't either. Right? Because American law, under any number of circumstances, allows for coercion also. Right. The classic cases where this is always, this always comes up in American law is blood transfusions for Jehovah's Witnesses, right? For religious groups that were Christian Scientists, right, who don't believe in medicine generally. Right. So there are all sorts of interesting test cases about this, and about this, the law will go back and forth for a long time. And it's probably different in America than it is in much of Western Europe, right? So, the notion that you can broad brush say there is the Western moral sentiment, as opposed to halakha, that would be very, very strong. Okay, good. So I want to say that I think that presentation on that issue is problematic. Yes, David.
Are we going to take this as a given we said that if you can coerce on this mitzvah, that goes against our notion of autonomy? Are we going to address the substance of whether this is a mitzvah you can?
Absolutely. Person? Absolutely. I just want to say what the theory is first, then we'll talk about it. Then we'll talk about whether he has right that, because the grounds he wants to set it up on here sounds like the only issue is whether there's a mitzvah to be healed, right? I want to bracket that whole question. I'm not interested in that question, right? I'm interested in the question of coercion, right? And that's what we'll spend a great deal of time on. Okay, let's take the second. The second question is: do you own your body? Okay, that's a very complicated claim, right? That informed consent is rests on the assumption that you own your body, whereas halakha believes that you don't own your body because some rabbis rule that a person has no ownership rights at all. Other rabbis rule that one cannot totally negate ownership over his body. Now, interestingly enough, although it says some rabbis and other rabbis, there's only one name really for each of them. Yes, Janet.
Also, when we're talking about do we own our body, how can you commit suicide, which I
Well, so we'll talk about what does it mean to own your body, and we have...
If you don't, you don't have a lot to do with that, right?
Exactly the point. If it was your body, maybe you have a right to die, but not your body, then you have a right to handle it.
Well, you know, we have all the interesting questions. You know, what is it? We have to talk about it at great length. But, you know, for starters, right, as we'll see in the primary sugya here, let's suppose that I own this piece of paper, right? Does that mean that I can tear into a little bit of shreds for no reason whatsoever?
I'm just saying suicide versus homicide. That's what I'm...
Right? It's all touches. Right, I can't...
What is the reason for
Baal
Tashrit?
I don't know.
Yeah, but is the reason because everything truly belongs to God?
Last I heard, we have to make brachos, where everything truly belongs to God. That's why we make a bracha rishona. So, prima facie, this is not the world. This is not even a starting argument to me. We'll talk about why it has such, right? Because God owns everything. Right? Or he owns nothing, right? Hashmayim, Lashem, the earth, and the Tam Livnei Adam. Right? It all belongs to us. Our bodies are... Yeah, I mean, right, you have the philosophic the notion, first of all, like the notion that some rabbis rule that a person has ownership is all right, you know, you're ruling, the notion that there's halacha on a philosophic abstraction like that is a very interesting notion.
But ownership, yeah, philosophically God owns anything, but legally that's not true.
Right.
We
so,
property,
last I checked, at the very least, okay, let's take like the most extreme offensive example, right? Last I checked, women own their bodies because they can sell them, right? That's right.
That's
so I was like, what is this? Right? What is, so, what?
That's like a Kenyan Tara. That's not a Kenyan.
Oh. Right? I'm just like, I am. You can sell yourself as an Evid Ivri under some circumstances.
Okay, so that makes an argument. Maybe you do have ownership of your body.
This is
a legal question.
So what I would say is that the question of, the question of, do you have ownership? Ownership over your body or not, ownership is an abstraction. Okay, right? If you study, the halakha of ownership is a remarkably complicated, fun thing, right? This is one of the things we're really proud of, is how much we complicate the notion of ownership, right? Where you can say, oh, look, right, the goslin has kinyan egzela, right? So he owns the object in a sense, right? So ownership, so you have the, you know, ownership you can claim, and if the ownership doesn't exist, it's just in a conglomerative category. Right, the issue that comes up here is whether the fact that people rule a certain way on a certain complex of issues predicts how they'll rule on other issues. That's really the question. Right, now there are certain things that sort of assimilates ownership with regard to property. Right, will they help you predict things about other things about the property? Right, that's, I think we'll have to try and see. The notion that you can paskin whether people own themselves is a very hard notion because ownership is so complicated.
Well, then how do we explore another thing? Like, the classic example that keeps going on in my mind is like Havavah.
Yeah.
So, because you think that the person's on your property might harm you, you can therefore kill them.
Right.
So that's making, so what is owning, so if I own this property, if I don't own my body owns the property, what does that mean?
I could break it down and say that no, there's no such thing as ownership. Right? All there is ownership
is
an abstraction.
But
I could kill somebody else if he breaks into my hotel. If somebody breaks into my hotel room via a tunnel, I can kill them too, even though I don't own the hotel room. Right? So it's not like ownership is not the relevant category there. The relevant category is plausible threat. Right now, the interesting question is. Yeah, because it's not plausible they're threatening me.
But they broke into the tunnel.
No, because let's suppose I'm staying in your house, right? But I put a big note in the paper saying I'm staying in your house with my famous collection, all right, of rare baseball cards, right? And somebody.
Not comic books.
I actually only own three comic books, I think, and not that one, unfortunately. But the I was hoping that would be valuable and rare, but my kids have dropped it, so my copy of The Killing Joke is no longer valuable. It's not mint anymore. But someone breaks into my room in your house, right? I spot someone digging a tunnel, right, and I go through the basement, I get to the tunnel behind them, and I'm allowed to whack them over the head, even though it's not my house. Probably. Right? Probably. Well, the exception, and here's where, the reason that becomes important is why, right, is as following. Why do I have the right to attack, to bang them over, to, right, to attack him by hitting him over the head, as opposed to simply leaving the room before he gets there? Right, that's a really important question. Right, not what I have the right to defend myself. Why do I have the right to? Why do I have the right to choose to attack as opposed to surrender? If it's plausible that in fact he would take the baseball cards and and leave me alone. So that seems to imply, right, that I have a certain right to maintain my use of objects that I currently am socially recognized as having the use of. But does that mean that I have the right to take the same baseball cards and deface them? No, maybe I have a responsibility to history. Even if I were, even if I didn't own the baseball cards, but I was the caretaker for a museum, I might still have the right to this, right? The ownership, I don't know that it's particularly implicating ownership. I would be careful about saying ownership as such is the issue. I think that the right to live in your own house is not necessarily the same thing as ownership, for example. Right? I may have the right to live in a rented house. I have the right to live in even a shack on someone's public ground. I don't know if I were illegally squatting. Right? It's an interesting question. If I'm illegally squatting on someone else's territory and somebody else digs a tunnel into my house, am I liable for killing them because I should have left the house? Because it was illegal. I'm assuming that it's illegal, right? There's no. The guy's made a macha in front of three people who's traveling. I know perfectly well, right? You know, right? But nonetheless.
What if your own possession is inside someone's house?
Pardon?
What if you have your own possession inside somebody else's house?
Yeah. Right. I think that's a real issue. That's why I'm not so sure it relates to. What if the possessions are stolen? Right. All sorts of things like that. Right. Right, but I still, right, they're stolen, but I know the person would kill me to get them, and I'm not going to give them up, so I can create the same presumption. Right? I'm killing him because he would kill me first, right, but I don't have a right to the stuff, right? That's not so clear. That's my focus for Shonim. Whether the American law notion of this is called an unclean hands doctrine, right, that whoever did the first wrong thing is responsible for all the consequences. That's one theory above a machteret. But the other theory is that it doesn't matter who has unclean hands, it matters who raised the stakes to capital, right? And those are different, and that's a machloket. Yes.
I was just wondering, what if the person tunneling, say you're squatting, and the person who tunnels in is the rightful owner of that property?
Interesting question. Interesting question. Okay. I want to bracket the ownership of your body issue because I think that assumes that ownership of your body is a simple question. I think it's actually a very complicated question, and we're going to spend. Right, exploring those two questions, one of coercion and the other of ownership of the body, is basically what the heart of the summer is going to be. But I hope we'll end up with much more complicated notions of what each of the questions, not just up and down answers, but much more complicated notions of the questions. Okay. Following that, what Dr. Steinberg gives you is a list of apodictic statements. Right, this is the halakha. Okay, about a whole series of cases. Many more in the encyclopedia than in the article, but fundamentally both of them, the difference is the encyclopedia tends to say in other people's voices, in the article he tends to agree with the outcomes of this, but it's basically the same methodology, which is, here is a list of precedents. Okay, now that is a challenging methodological claim for now. First of all, let's talk about how varied are the precedents. How many different people does he have? If you look, you'll see a lot of the footnotes are the Sicilia.
He's in charge
of the hospital. Right, so Sicilia is a great posseg, but it's one shita. Right, and the Sicilia unquestionably, right, Dr. Steinberg is, I think, faithfully reflecting the attitude of the Sicilia in many shuvos. But if Sicily Ezer is the only one who wrote about these things, I don't know that it necessarily tells you that the broad brush of halakha. Yes, Mish.
So, is his stated goal, maybe I missed this, but is his stated goal
to have the broad perspective of halakha throughout the entire history of halakha, or is it to have practical and what he sees as relevant for our generation?
I think it's relevant for our generation, but I think it's presented as this is the halakha, right? Where it is, there's not. Here's a better way of framing it. I think that what he does is he tends to be against uncertainty in presentation. So if somebody has presented a position on the issue, right, he will tend to present that as the position on the issue.
I mean, isn't that a given at any time you're making a decision? Like, if you have, you know, two rabbis in the Gemara arguing, it's okay that they say that their position is the position, even though they know in the back of their mind, all right, I know there are people that disagree.
Right. Well, Tzitz Eliezer can say that.
Yeah,
right, Tzitz Eliezer is paskening.
Well, why can't he?
So he can say, I paskin that way. I guess,
that's what he's doing, though.
That's fine, except I think that at least you might misperceive an encyclopedia.
If this isn't a paper, it's true. If this isn't an encyclopedia,
right.
When you're writing an encyclopedia, you should be encyclopedic.
Well, but what's the stated goal? Like, even though, okay, it has the name encyclopedia, but I don't know, I didn't...
Okay, so I'm not so interested in... I assume that he's honest about what he wants to do. Right, so I'm interested, but I think the perception of encyclopedias, reasonably, people don't necessarily read the prefaces, and people pick up an encyclopedia and they'll assume what they're getting is the consensus.
But is it an encyclopedia of halacha or an encyclopedia of medical ethics, according to his piskei?
Encyclopedia of...
It's two very different things. If
medical halacha.
So if it's an encyclopedia of halacha versus an encyclopedia of medical ethics, right? The encyclopedia of halacha would need to be more inclusive of all the different halacha.
It's an encyclopedia of halacha.
Whereas if it, is that his statement?
But I don't think he's leaving out anything. I'm not thinking of leaving out anything, right? But he assumes, I think, that anything which has been decided in the absence of explicit controversy is settled. Right, as opposed to saying, you know what, this issue, there's some people, right, the Tzitz Eliezer wrote about this, and in 50 years, we'll know what the halacha is. That's a different perspective.
Just generally, if there is a truth that decides on an issue and there's nothing that contradicts it, can't people make the reasonable assumption that halacha, and that's why you put them as, even if there might be different makoros that go against it, as long as there's no shita achir in that specific case, can we...
It's a plausible way of doing it, and if you look at the way other legal systems function, that's the way some people function, and other people say, no, you know what, that issue hasn't been right for decision yet, right? So this person addressed it, but we thought it was premature. Right? Another way of looking at it is that, right, some people, right, it's like, let's say in America, often there are uncontested lower court decisions because the Supreme Court has not yet been willing to address an issue. Right? So it's an important question, let's say, right? Whether in halakha you want to assume that the first stock settles the issue until somebody explicitly disagrees, or if you say that no, an issue is unsettled until you have a lot of tshuvos by lots of people saying the same thing. And until then, what you have is the first person as an outlier. Right? He got his sheet out. That's great. And it may also be that the answer is different as to whether you're addressing this as a layperson or as a rabbi. Right? For a layperson, you might say, well, that's all there is. Right, if you're posting, you might say, okay, look, you know, I got room. Okay, Rob had a question then, Dave.
Yeah, and so it just seems like what you're saying is that basically there are lots of plausible shitos that could exist. Only one has come out into existence at this point. But that doesn't necessarily mean that is the correct shita. However, if this is addressed only to the layperson, and that layperson wants to rely on that shita, then they're perfectly
able
to do that.
To claim that you can't be Somech on Tzitz Eliezer, I'm not going to say you can't be Somech on Tzitz Eliezer.
Right.
It happens that a lot of issues, in terms of medical halakha, the Tzitz Eliezer is going to be what's in print, because he's the one who got asked these shilas. Right? And he sat down and wrote Shuvot about them. Right? And other people, right, and lots of other things, people might say, there might be whole areas of halakha where people might say, you know what, I think that's psak, but I'm not willing to put it in writing. Right? Or, you know what, I don't think you should ask him that question. I should write up, or it might just be that people say, you know what, I don't know. Okay, yes, David.
So what does that mean, the issue is settled until someone explicitly disagrees? Because I, as a rabbi answering the shiloh, can be that one who explicitly disagrees.
That's right. But for a layperson, it might be that the answer is it's settled right now. You have no choices.
So the layperson just has to go to the rabbi then, and then it's not settled.
If the rabbi chooses to unsettle it. Right? And again, we'll use the term rabbi, you know, whatever, postig. I'd rather use postig than rabbi. But yeah, I think there are things, I mean, again, I think in American law, there are things that are settled law. Right? So, right? And they're settled law until somebody decides to unsettle them. And then when they unsettle them, somebody looks at you and says, how can you do that? That was settled law. And either they win, in which case all of a sudden it's not settled law anymore. Right? This is the whole issue, right? The Kagan hearings are going on right now, right? That the current Supreme Court is not such a strong believer in the notion of settled law. Right? Justice Souter was a very strong believer in the notion of settled law, and even expanded extreme, you know, to my mind, into very extreme categories when he declared Roe v. Wade settled law, right? And you know, and that had a huge impact on constitutional jurisprudence. And now we have the backlash against that.
Everything is settled law until five justices in the Supreme Court.
That's right. But he argued that. Even in cases where five justices, but his argument in Roe v. Wade was that even where five justices disagreed with it, it would be wrong to change it. That was a very interesting argument, that because people had lived their lives on the basis of it now, it would be unfair. I think in that particular case, it was a mistake constitutionally, but I appreciate it more as time goes by. At the time, I was just mad, and right now I have more of an understanding of what the rationale behind it was. And maybe I'll yet come to terms with it. Okay. In general, my limited experience in encyclopedia is that it will present the precedents and it will not spend its time qualifying the precedents, which is a legitimate methodological procedure. Right, here's an example that came up for me. Electroshock therapy. Is electroshock therapy mutter? So there's one tshuva that says electroshock therapy is mutter. That's all that comes up in the encyclopedia. Now that one tshuva happens to be from the 1950s, Australia, where they were into it as a way of reforming prisoners. right? Now, attitudes toward electroshock therapy have come and gone since then. And fairly dramatically. The period was totally out, now it's back in. But the encyclopedia, and I don't think this is wrong, I just have to be aware of it, just the halacha on electroshock therapy is there was a tshuva written which said it was mutter. Okay, right, so I think you have to be very careful about using an anthologist that way, right? It's almost an uncritical anthology that way. If a posig is treated as a legitimate posig, then their shita is held, and you have to do the work yourself to figure out what's unique about the case. Okay, so I think there's a risk in that. In using I would encourage you to use the encyclopedia as a place for Makaro, but then right, be leery of just assuming that the picture of halacha is exactly as presented. I would complicate it. Okay. I also wanted you to see his as a contrast his article in the journal, because his article. His article, when he's writing for a secular audience, assumes that informed consent is a value and everybody has to go along with it. Right? I think that's a fair presentation, right? And so the question is, right, is he dissembling? Is that just your reality? I think it's worth thinking about that. To me, the big issue is informed consent is a given in the entire medical world. So, right, the question, do we want to just set a halakha up as a critique of it and say informed consent is given the medical world and halakha doesn't really buy into that, but we have to go along, or do we say that we would rather construct halakha within the assumption of informed consent, which is the world everyone lives in? I think that's an important broad question. Okay, I do want to move to reading primary sources in the. I don't want to give a first year Justin article. Okay, so now let's. What we did in the analysis, we showed that. Really, the key issue is not so much whether there is a mitzvah to be healed, but whether there is a capacity to coerce to be healed. So what is the earliest source that tells you that you can coerce a patient to be healed? That he cites. Right, what's his makor for the claim? L'tal dam re'echa tells you that you, right, how does that tell you that you have an obligation to heal yourself?
To heal yourself
with the coerce
people
to coerce other people to be healed. So where does L'tal dam re'echa give you a right of coercion, coercing others? Interesting claim. Who makes that claim? Right, is that you mean on page 555?
Okay,
148 in the original article, okay, yeah. Okay, good, yes. So let's be careful, he quotes the Moruk Tzia, quoting Lotan Odam Reacha. Right? Now, so what I want to ask you is, does he have any source prior to the Moruk Tzia? Moruk Tzia is Rav Yaakov Emden. I'm sorry, I didn't make that clear on the biography sheet. Right, the Moruk Tzia is Rav Yaakov Emden, right? So we're talking in the late 18th century, right? So is there any source prior to the 18th century, which a halachic source, which says explicitly that patients can be coerced to accept treatment? Yes, Rob?
Possibly the Magen Avraham.
Possibly the Magen Avraham. Okay, but he doesn't quote the Magen Avraham.
He quotes the Red Baz,
right? Magen Avraham quotes the Radbaz, and the Moruk Tzia quotes the Magen Avraham quoting the Radbaz.
Right.
And Steinberg quotes the Magen Avraham, right, quotes the Moruk Tzia quoting the Magen Avraham quoting the Radbaz. Okay. If you read the encyclopedia, right, so far as I know, the only direct authority you have is the Moruk Tzia. Right, so we're in the 18th century. It's the first, right, we have no, right, there is no claim that there is a Talmudic source. Which says it. Right? There's no claim that there's a Rishon who says it. Right? Because even at the furthest back we get is the Red Buzz. It's already an Akhra. So that's an interesting phenomenon. Whenever we have an issue which should have come up. And the first person you can find referring to it is in the 16th century. And right, then you have an interesting question. So I want to go back and let's see actually. Now, if we could undo that, right? So here's what I want to argue, right? Once we establish that the core issue is whether there is tfiya to accept refua, and it turns out that that argument comes from the Moruk Tzia, if we can say it doesn't say that at all, then it turns out that we have no argument, that he has no argument, his argument doesn't even get started. Right? So a lot depends on this Moruk Tzia. Now, I'll tell you that it's not just this. If you can read many, many articles on this subject, and it will turn out that basically the only makor they have is the Moruk Tzia. That's a very interesting question. Let's go read the makor. It's a very interesting question. So I want to start with the Shulchan Aruch. Okay, Shulchan Aruch says, Kol choli sharofim amin shu sakana, afav hishu ala basar bin b'chutz mechalil alav et ha-shabbat. Okay, so any medical condition that the doctors claim is a threat to whatever it is considered to be a threat to whatever is considered a sufficient threat, even though it is external, right? We're functioning in a medical world which distinguishes sharply between external and internal injuries and illnesses, right? You can be mechalel Shabbat alone, right? Nonetheless, even external wounds, if the doctors claim that it's a risk, then you can be mechalel Shabbat. But if there's a dispute among doctors, nonetheless, you're still mechal Shabbos. Okay, and but some people say v'yesh mishomer she'ein tzarich mumche, d'chol v'adam chashuvim mumchin k'sat v'safik nefeshot l'akel, and some people say it doesn't even require doctors. Right, anybody who comes along and says, "Wow, that cut might infect, and you might die of sepsis," that's enough. Okay, and the Ramah says only Jews. Right? Non-Jews have to be non-Jews have to be licensed medical professionals in order for their opinion to count halachically. Okay, they're not our issue right now as to why that might be. Okay, on this the Magen Avraham says, right, Rafe Echad Amer Tzarich, V'in L'Ritza HaCholeh L'Kabel Trufa Kufinoto, right, and if the Choleh does not wish to accept the medicine, you compel him. Choleh Amer Tzarich Ani L'Trufa Plonit, Rafe Amer Ein Tzarich, Shomin L'Choleh, V'im Rafe Amer Shoto Trufa Yazikeyu, Shomin L'Rafe. So there's a dispute between the doctor and the patient, so you listen to the patient even to the point of being Mechal Shabbos, if there is no risk incurred by disobeying the doctor. But if the doctor claims that the patient's opinion is not only wrong but dangerous, then you don't heed the patient against the doctor. Yes, Daniel?
All of this seems to be kind of based on this idea that the more we do, the better.
Yeah.
Short of if it's almost sure to cause actual harm when you do something.
Mm-hmm.
Where is that coming from? Is that just an assumption we have to work with? That if you can do something, then it's better than not doing anything.
Because it's pikuach nefesh. I mean, what we do nowadays, where we have an interesting question, like you claim, well, you know, giving unnecessary antibiotics causes public health risks. Right? That's a really interesting question.
Saying, like, with the doctor says you don't need it, and you say you need it. Then
yeah. So what's the risk? If the doctor says there's a risk, right? Then that's the, right. Then we don't do it. But assuming there's no risk,
so
again.
Assuming that the doctor always knows if there's a risk or not.
We're saying that even we don't know if the doctor knows it. We're saying that. We trust you to determine your own illness, but not when there's a risk to the doctor. But not when the doctor says there is. That's
no,
right.
But if the doctor doesn't say there's a risk, we're assuming that
yeah,
it's
we're
not because there is no risk.
That's right. We're assuming we're assuming that the chance that you're right, that you're sick, is greater than the chance of the risk.
Okay.
The risk to McCure, the doctor says, is not dangerous. Okay. So now let's parse this case. Right. What exactly? Sorry, was there a pun there? I missed.
No, I think I see where you're going with it.
So, what exactly does the Magen Avraham say? Right, say you can coerce for. Pardon?
To heal him.
All the time.
The doctor says.
All the time.
For specifically.
No.
No.
Yes, David.
On Shabbos.
You can coerce him on Shabbos. Now that would be very hard to imagine. That it means you can coerce him through Mechal Shabbat and you can't coerce him during the week. Right? That would be very hard to believe.
Why? If he doesn't want to treat it because of his
acceptance,
then
that's a very different question. It's a very different question. What happened, right? So the first way of narrowing this is to claim is all the Magen Avraham says is that if the person doesn't want to be Mechal Shabbat, you can compel him to accept the medicine despite the Chilul Shabbat. Doesn't address the question of whether if he doesn't want to be healed generally. I don't know.
If you're forcing him,
yeah.
then you have permission to force him.
Right.
And why should it matter if it's Shabbat or week? I understand on Shabbat we call you a fuzzy chosen, you're supposed to be Mechal in that case.
Right.
And I understand harsh words. But when you say kofino, so that means that Beis Din or whoever does have an obligation to make sure that this person is healed.
No, you have an obligation to make sure that he's not a chatzin shoter. We force people not to be a chatzin shoter.
I think it's much more sensible to say we force a person to heal himself than not to be a chatzin shoter, because the only thing they're doing wrong by being a chatzin shoter is not healing themselves.
No.
Okay, well, Rob, make the counter argument.
The mistake that they're making is not a medical mistake. The mistake they're making is a religious mistake.
Absolutely.
They're saying that the value of keeping Shabbat is greater than the value of receiving medical treatment, and we know as religious experts that that's false. When it comes to what you're supposed to do medically, who knows? You know, that's the doctor's decision.
Right. I think that's an excellent formulation. We can force you to accept our halachic opinion, but we can't. Right? We can't force you to accept our medical opinion.
Yeah, but what's the halachic opinion?
The halachic opinion is that it's mutter to be mechal Shabbos for pikuach nefesh.
But then you're already saying that it's pikuach nefesh.
Right, it's pikuach nefesh. And pikuach nefesh overrides Shabbos to the extent that you're not allowed to be motzi laws on a halachic system that it says you're supposed to die rather than break Shabbos.
In other words, so it's almost
not a meta halakha consideration, but you're more worried, what you're worried about is other people's reaction to what this person is doing as opposed to the actual thing that he's doing himself. Meaning, theoretically, if no one would find out about it and we didn't care about Marathai and a few of the Chadri, it's like, all right, we would let him do whatever he wants. But it's because what he's doing is he's misrepresenting the halakhic system, so that's what we really have a problem with.
It might be. A lot of it is for other people. It might be for himself. It might be that he's rebelling against rabbinic authority. He's declaring the right to paskin like himself against the halacha. It might be thinking it's really bad for his soul. Right? He's going to go up to Shemayim having the right, you know, and say, God, look, God, I died for you. And God will say, what? Not for me. Right? Is that impossible?
It's not impossible, but I think that the
okay.
reading of the moral tia is, no, it's a very valid reading. I don't think that the other reading is more valid.
Okay, good. Well, let's see if it's reading the moral tia first.
Whoever is the first person who says that Afilu Bechol.
Right, let's see.
Okay.
Let's see who the first person is. I think, okay, I'm open to the, I think that, I see Rob's point is plausible also, but I can't prove it. Right? It's a reasonable argument to say also that, you know, look, obviously this means that we would compel you when there's no halakhic value, right? It's a kosher king. Right? If we compel you to break Shabbos, then Kal v'chomer we break you when there's no, right? Or the other possibilities. No, here we call you the Chassid Shota, so that's in our jurisdiction. Right, okay, yes, David. Yeah.
So, Shabbos is one of those things we coerce for.
Sure.
Maybe the mitzvah to heal yourself is not one of those things we coerce for, simply because ain't makom karav b'tzida gadol mitzvah.
Okay, good, interesting argument. But we do want Shabbos, according to the Magen Avraham.
Yeah, Shabbos is a law, and why we coerce for either is not makom karav b'tzida.
Okay, I would say as follows. I'm gonna make it. We can narrow it even further. We can argue even further than just Chilul Shabbos, right? Well, the other, what's the Magen Avraham can be talking about an even narrower case, which is that we coerce you in cases where there is a dispute among doctors on Shabbos. So in cases like that, right, so what you're doing is you're claiming, right, not only you claim, we don't even coerce you to say that you can't give up your life for Shabbos, because that may be that the Machlokas Ashkenazim and Sfardim about whether you can give up your life voluntarily al Kiddush Hashem. But right here, you're making a halachic claim that suffik pikuach nefesh isn't docha Shabbos. Right, the Magen Avraham writes his issue about kofinotso. Right, he doesn't write it right on the issue of right. He could have written on the first line kol choli sharofim omer shu sakana afal v'yeshua besar miuchus v'chal levin es haShabbos v'imlo rata chol lekabel trufa kofinotso. He doesn't say that. He cuts on the next line when one doctor says yes and one doctor says no, then kofinoto. So we have the same argument. It could be saying that to say that we're kofe even if one doctor agrees with him, or it could be that we're saying that we're kofe only when one doctor disagrees with him. Right? Because it could be that that we're kofe specifically because of the issue of safek. We don't want people paskining for themselves that suffic, right? Because that's the real risk to social health is when people start paskining that suffic pikuach nefesh isn't docha Shabbos.
But then you'd also add another trust line. If it's all about pikuach nefesh, then there would also be the case on the first line that one doctor says you have to take and you don't want to take it.
That's right. So it might be, according to the Magen Avraham, that if a person says you're going to die if you're not mechal Shabbos, and he says, you know what? I don't want to die, right? I'd rather die than break Shabbos. Okay. You're a chassid shosa, so what?
But
if there's a disagreement among doctors and you say, I don't want to rely on that doctor, right? No, do you agree what the halacha is? You're just about right. You agree that halacha is you're allowed to be mechal Shabbos. You just don't want suffik because nevish. Maybe we're docha about suffik. Maybe we're kofa about suffik.
But
I think it's clever, but incorrect reading.
Well,
let me finish,
yes. No, it doesn't sound like it, because why would we care about the halakhic ruling that sounds like pikuach nefesh, though you have to follow our halakhic ruling, but...
We force you to follow halakhic ruling.
But pikuach nefesh, we don't.
Because we're not worried about other people following you. About Zadeh. Right? We trust in self-preservation.
It's such a technical argument that you would have had to say
it. You would have to say it.
Yeah, no, exactly right. It's exactly right. Sometimes,
Right? It's the example of being, you know, that we're more mocked under abundance than deoresis. Because this is the thing that requires social that requires
said,
social
like
sanction.
I would be more democratic by doing abundance than deoresis. You should have said it so that we know that's
what he said. Ah, so I would argue, but he did by only putting this line on the right on the this comment on the second line.
But no, the argument you could say is no, he put it on the second line to say you always go by the book method. And
right, okay.
That would also lead to uncold, of course, you point.
Although he could have put it after the third line too, you know, which is even more mafia, right? You don't even need a mumcha. He only puts in the line that is a doctor. So according to your shita, we'll probably have to hold that we don't force him if a non-mumcha tells him it's the kanas nefashos. Right? Because there are three cases, right?
Yeah, no,
right? So if your reading is right that he's being precise at where he puts it, he's trying, right? So you have to claim he's putting it as a culture cane, then, right? He doesn't say it about the third case, so it has to not apply to the third case.
Saying,
he wasn't being suspected. That seems just to go off nefesh, but you point and that whatever. Right, but it's 3K, right? So if he's trying to be mafia on people of nefesh, then he's waiting to say it till the second case.
It could just be nobody, could be just talking about Shabbos and Kol, and that's the culture game.
No, it's Shabbos in the first case also. It's Shabbos in all three cases. Right, the three cases are in order of A, all doctors agree, B, there's a dispute among doctors, C, right, see that even if the person who says you have to be Mechal Shabbos isn't the doctor. Right, he puts it on the second. Right, so either he doesn't hold it about the third or he doesn't hold it about the first. Yes, Rob.
How reliable is our knowledge of where the Bar Matzah
lives? That's an excellent question. So I put on the,
yeah.
Right, we don't, they're not going to have problems, you know, the rotten edition. So, but what's the real issue? What's the issue we know about the Dibra Matzah?
I mean,
What issue we know is there about Zevri Mashal?
He quotes the Rug too.
Well, we know that. And what do we know about the Moruk Sia? What does the Moruk Sia say? Moruk Sia begins by saying, That means that our Dibra Matzah is the right is according to the emendation of the Moruk Sia. So you have to figure out what the Dibra Matzah was before then. I don't think he invented the Herd of Cakes. I assume that the original Dibra Matzah, the one that was in Rofei HaKadomar, Eino Tzarech. But, he took out the Eino. And we're thinking about why he thought Eino was wrong. I assume the Dibra Matzah is, but I don't know. I don't have access to earlier editions of the Dibra Matzah. All right. So we have three possible readings of the Magen Avraham. Okay, A is he thinks you can force, he can always force patients to be healed. B is he thinks you can force patients to be healed rather than Mechal Shabbos. C is he thinks you can force patients to be healed rather than not allow Shabbos to be Mechulal Misafek. Okay.
Sorry,
again, A is that you can always force patients to be healed. B is you can force patients to be healed if they claim that they'd rather die than be Mechal Shabbos. And C is you can force patients to be healed if they claim that they'd rather die than rely on a suffix, Pikuach Nefesh, to be Docha Shabbos. Okay. So in the interest of time, I'm now going to frustrate a lot of you in terms of time spent on the Makarot, which I hope you did really valuably. We're going to ran through the next two Makarot at extremely high speed, as follows. Let's see. All right, Tal, you're on again. So what does Mishnah Berurah say about Kfiyah?
I haven't seen the Mishnah Berurah before.
You haven't seen the Mishnah Berurah?
No.
You didn't get that far.
You skipped ahead. Kfiyah along with the article. Rather than
All right. That's a good check on me. But I had the Makarot in order. So someone tell me, what does Mishnah Berurah say about Kfiyah? This is where we tell it.
Right?
He quotes the Radbaz. Is it about Kfiyah? The correct answer is nothing. This is where we tell the story of Dr. Soloveitchik throwing us out of shir one day because he asked us to prepare the Gemara with the Didukei Sofrim, and he came and he said, what Kirsa changes the Didukei Sofrim record? And the correct answer was none, but we were all assumed we had missed something. We couldn't answer that. So he was really, really angry with us. Because, like, if you're prepared, you're willing to say none. And the answer was none. There were no changes at all. So the answer is yes. The correct answer is Mishnah Berurah says absolutely nothing about Kfiyah. All right. Now that you have a clue. So, let's see. Roy, what does the Bir Halacha say about Kfiyah? Which is to say,
nothing.
Okay, and now for the grand prize in the $24,000 pyramid, Yair, what does the Radbaz say about Kfiyah?
Well,
uh huh. And Elliot, the correct answer is
that if the doctor says you have to take it, you have to take it.
Show it to me in the Rabbah. Correct answer is nothing. So now we go back to the Moroksia. Okay, look at the game, the Moroksia. The Moroksia says, Kasuv Magen Avraham b'shem Radbaz. Now we go back to the Magen Avraham and we look and we see where is the footnote to the Radbaz? At the end. And there are three lines in the Magen Avraham. Two of them are in the Radbaz. The last two, which is what the footnote relates to. And the one that's about Kfiyah, the Radbaz does not say at all. But the Moroksia never saw the Radbaz, as we know because he gets the footnote wrong. Right, the Magen Avraham saw the Radbaz, but the first line isn't the Magen Avraham quoting the Radbaz at all. So actually, the Moroksia is built on a mistake.
Well, he's built on the Magen Avraham.
Moroksia believes that the Magen Avraham is quoting the Radbaz.
Does it really matter?
That is an interesting question.
If we care about what he's saying rather than who's saying it, then it doesn't matter. But if we care in terms of, like, you know, the system of authority of who has more authority, then it doesn't matter. I'm saying what's
for believing what he said, because you should look at the initial makoros.
But if he's believing what he says because it has value, then it doesn't matter who said it. But if he's believing in what he says because of who said it, then it's
okay. Good. Good. Okay. So now, I also want to talk about whether my reading of the Magen Avraham becomes more plausible once you understand that the first line of Magen Avraham is entirely Da'at Atzmo and not actually a citation of the Radbaz. Right? Which of the three readings you offer the Magen Avraham fits better? I think it's an open question. I think you have to consider it. Yes, Tobi.
Yeah, is the Shabbat Shimon Radbaz that you have on here?
Yeah.
Is it not the one cited in the footnotes?
Yes, because all the footnotes are, you'll see every footnote to the Shulchan Radbaz is different because most of them are just reading the footnote in the Magen Avraham and they're misreading it.
Wait, what?
In other words, there are typos. When people haven't looked up the Tshuva themselves, they're just reading somebody else's footnote and citing it. Then you get typos.
Wait, what is in the Radbaz to about?
There isn't any such thing, I don't think. I think that's just a pure typo. let's take a look. Right.
Well, I'll look. I have probably one.
Right. The it's actually Dalit Samach Vav. You'll see this. Right. You can take a look. I think it's pretty clear this is the intended Shuva.
Okay.
I think it's pretty clear. You can check. If you find another Shuva that actually mentions the last two lines but not the first, that would be impressive. okay. Yes, Rob.
Is there enough command between for our purposes between the second and third reading of the Magen Avraham?
Sure. Because the Nafka Mina is cases where there's something where there's different, narrower class of cases.
But for our version,
for our purpose, both the second and third.
Oh, either the second and third reading would get me would. Either the second and third reading would undermine the argument against informed consent. That's
right.
True. It would be sufficient. Yeah.
Okay.
Okay, good. So now the question, right, the debate that Moshe and Janice were having, I think, is an excellent question, which is, does this matter? So to here, I want to add one more thing. That's the last thing we're going to do today. So one of the really interesting, challenging notions is whether one reads a text solely for its outcomes, or whether literary structure matters. Whether you can talk about things like the direction of the text. I think that's a complicated question, and I think the answer is different for different texts. I'm going to argue at various points here that in Gemara it matters a great deal, at least for some readings. Other texts, not so much. So I'm going to ask a dangerous and possibly trivial question, which is like in a good high school essay form. Right? What's the main point of the Moro Ketzia? Right, what is the purpose? Right, what is the purpose of the Moro Ketzia in writing this? Right, in writing this paragraph.
To establish a framework in which one does and one does not coerce the patient.
To establish a framework which one does and does not coerce the patient. Good. That's not a bad answer.
Establish.
Not a bad answer. I'm gonna set up one stark claim. Let's see if right as an extreme. Let's suppose that the Moro Ketzia is not a commentary on the Shulchan Aruch. It's a commentary on the Shulchan Aruch with Magen Avraham. Okay, that's a big difference, right? Whether you're looking at it, right? As one way is to say the Moro Ketzia looks at the Shulchan Aruch and he decides whom to quote, and look, he quotes the Magen Avraham. He must really believe in that. Right? Second possibility is no, he assumes the Magen Avraham. And what his contribution is figuring out is what he says in response to the Magen Avraham, which he assumes. Okay, let's take the second possibility. Let's assume that the Moro Ketzia here, at least here, takes as his ground the existence of the Shulchan Aruch plus the Magen Avraham. What is then the purpose of this paragraph?
To define what the Magen Avraham.
To define? Good. To define the talk, let's push it further. Define in which direction? To limit or to expand?
Well, I think limit.
Yes. So that's the thing, right? That's the strongest statement of the thesis I can set out. Is that the Moro Ketzia works on the premise that there is a binding precedent of coercion. And he works on that premise because he believes there's a Shu'at Radbaz. And the thrust of his argument is to say, even though the Magen Avraham says that you can be kosher, actually that only applies in the following context. What would he have said if you had told him, guess what, there's no Shu'at Radbaz whatsoever about Kriya? The Magen Avraham made that up.
Then he might not have had
said. He might not have said the same thing at all. Exactly right. He might have said, oh, good, no Kriya. All right, yes, David.
Is our second read of the Magen Avraham so absurd that if he really had such a problem with Tzvia, he couldn't have read the Magen Avraham our way?
So I think that relates to the question of whether my reading becomes read right, our. We can now become our reading if you want. I'm happy to share credit. Right, becomes more or less plausible on the assumption the Magen Avraham has to be read as a unit. As if you assume that the Magen Avraham is more likely to be read our way once you separate line one, but if you put those three lines together, then it has to be reading A, right? Then Rav Yaakov Emden, who assumed those three lines together, could not have read it that way. But if you, right, that's right, that's why all those arguments are interconnected. Okay, yes, Tevye. Everyone holds that under some circumstances. That's what I was saying. Show me holds up this specific mitzvah.
If you're in Kofin on the Sadatse, Shematan Sara Vesiva, and knowing that you're going to die is Ein Matan Sara Vesiva Gadol Vizu.
I would be leery of programmatic statements on an issue like that. I don't think that Rabbaz believes that you can, that you can be kofa on every mitzvah d'aseh. I don't believe anyone believes there's no mitzvah d'aseh you can be kofa for. I would want a more precise evidence.
I think Avram Steinberg might believe that.
yeah, I don't. I would be as my offhand say. All the mitzvahs you're not kofa for, we are in fact kofa for in practice. Well, right, if you study that, all the trivial literature is about why we're kofa for stuck, even though we're not, right? All right, and keep it out of aim, right? All those sort of things. I'd be very leery about programmatic statements like that.
Uh-huh.
Right, you have to be more detailed than that to show it to me.
But why should you though? Forget the matan for a second, and I'm not in the studio, but assuming that kofim is a thing that we do, it's not an absurd claim. Just because...
It's all right, but they're about to, it might be true, but okay, let's... Right. Not nogea. You want to claim that every Rishon who holds kofin on mitzvah d'aseh holds that we're kofin on pikuach nefesh, that's great, but there's no... We don't need the Radbaz for that. The point is that this Rad... That Magen Avraham is not based on this Radbaz.
Okay, but I think that the argument could be made, the Magen Avraham is based on the Radbaz.
Right. Good, you can make the argument just off the, right, and that would make an argument that, forget informed consent, right, halacha just doesn't believe in autonomy. Right, that's a straightforward thing. Halacha believes that you can be, that if any time you choose to do something wrong, we force you. That's a straightforward argument, okay.
Well, gives him autonomy. He says, no, you can choose what to do when the thing's inside, as long as you're not killing yourself.
So I think that we don't. I mean, you want to take that extreme? The halacha has no space whatsoever. We force you to do it, right? And not only that, we can force you, but we do force you, right? And the job of Beis Din is to force you to do every single mitzvah, right? So we send people to drag you out of bed for minion in the morning, right?
In those situations, it's not practical. But when it's the case when a person is on the operating table and the person is about to die and the person is refusing treatment. I think that is a case where it makes sense to apply kofi no.
Good. So we have to be careful about almost, right? So I want to be, it is very possible to believe that you can force somebody not to refuse treatment when the obvious result of refusing treatment is imminent death. You can do that in two ways. You can do that either there's a much simpler way than kfiya to do that. Not even kof nefesh, which is to claim that is prima facie evidence of insanity. All right, and then we no longer need you, right, and they no longer competent. That's a much easier way to do it. Umdud of the mukhacha, anybody who refuses treatment is insane. That's right, you don't need to resort to kfiya. You don't need to resort to kfiya for that. But what happens if somebody looks at me and says, but Rabbi Clapper, you haven't put chamomile lotion on your mosquito bites. Right, does it follow from that the Radbaz believes that a gendarmerie should be rushing in here to apply chamomile lotion to my mosquito bites?
That's not a topic.
No, okay, good. So now we're talking about, right, so, but let's suppose I concede there is a mitzvah to heal. Does it automatically follow that it's because there's a mitzvah to heal that I should do that? That you should be able to compel me to treat all my cuts so I heal it?
I'm not going to make that assumption. I mean, you could make all sorts of claims of, what if the Torah said that it's a mitzvah to mass murder everyone? I don't think it is. I think the Torah is a mitzvah. Besides the Hamas is a mitzvah. I don't think that there's really very much impetus to say that healing every single possible thing is wrong for you.
So I'm comfortable saying that healing is a mitzvah, and like all other mitzvahs, we make decisions on some kind of case by case basis or a broader basis about whether or not to be kofi. And that doesn't implicate the broader question of autonomy, right? Because I don't know what the criteria are. Right? It means autonomy is a value, the right decision is a value. I don't know how that plays out yet. I'm comfortable saying that. And then there's no evidence of it. Right? The prior claim was that there's a specific Radbaz that says about this mitzvah specifically, we are kofa under all circumstances. I'm now suggesting is that A,
even the Magen Avraham doesn't say about all circumstances, and B, the Radbaz never said it. All right, how much further we go from that? That's still a lot of room. Okay. Yes, John.
It's still unclear to me what mitzvah we're talking about. I mean, the tzukim that are being quoted are clearly not.
Sure. And we'll get to that. Sure, we'll get to that. We'll get to that. We'll get to that. We'll get to whether there's a mitzvah or not. But I'm willing to concede there is a mitzvah. I just point out that the move from that mitzvah to kfiyah, if the only evidence we have of it is kofen al mitzvah aseh bichlal, so then we can engage the issue much more broadly. Right, we're not talking about medical ethics anymore. We're talking about generally, can we force you to do all mitzvah aseh? And I think I'm comfortable saying that there are going to be spaces where we're not kofen you, for whatever reason. Okay, yes, Mesh.
Really technical. Mm-hmm. Why wouldn't the Rabbi Yaakov Emden have seen the
Red Buzz?
The Red Buzz, was it?
Because it's just not a very, you know, like, people didn't have books.
Yeah. But it was just...
Yeah, I just didn't have the books. It's a big book, and it's a Sephardi. I don't know how many copies of the Shulchan Aruch existed. I really don't know. Maybe Rabbi Yonatan Ivish has impounded all the copies of the Shulchan Aruch. Don't let him get a hold of that one as a way of diminishing his authority. I couldn't... Okay, now, but having said that, right, and then we're gonna finish with this, and maybe next time we'll pick up and read the Rav Yaakov Emden inside, at least parts of it. Rav Yaakov Emden does allow for kfiyah in particular circumstances, or even mandate kfiyah in particular circumstances. There's no way out of that. Right, he does, and the circumstances are not as narrow as the circumstances of the reading of the Magen Avraham, that I put forth. So Rav Yaakov Emden certainly functions as a precedent. To what degree that precedent is under, right, is devalued by the recognition that it's a precedent based on a false assumption is up to you. But he certainly serves as a precedent for kfiyah in a broader swath of cases than the narrow reading the Magen Avraham might put forward. What we'll have to do next time is to see, right, exactly what cases of Rav Yaakov Emden, right, how broadly does Rav Yaakov Emden actually allow kfiyah, and whether there is evidence in his understanding that he bases his allowing of kfiyah on some type of broad notion of rejection of autonomy, right, as opposed to a narrow argument about pikuach nefesh, and you know what, pikuach nefesh overrides Shabbos, maybe it overrides autonomy, right? Here's the easy way of framing it, right? Maybe autonomy is a mitzvah like 610 others, right? Is a value on the level of 610 mitzvah, right? But it's not docha, pikuach nefesh, gilui arayos, right, or avodah zarah. Right? That's an easy way of making the argument. Right? So I want to explore it, again, and see whether his grounds for kfiyah are daska pikuach nefesh, or whether he is built on some kind of broad theoretical framework about lack, right, autonomy not being a value, you're not owning your own body or things like that. Obviously, I'm tipping my hand, and my bias is very much towards reading him in the theoretical level as narrowly as possible. Right, and I think it would be evidentiary of that if it turns out that his halachic reading is also very narrow. All right, thank you very much. So the way we usually do it is we take a half-hour break from whenever Shir is done, and if Shir starts running too long with some regularity, or extremely too long in a specific context, you should tell me. You should tell me that so I don't lecture to an audience that's completely gone. Because I sometimes go too long. Some years that's great, and some years it's too long. Okay, so we should reconvene for standard learning of your choice at 3:30. 3:33. And people show up. People show up. You should learn with them. And if you wish to have the official Rabbi Avi Weiss fun moment, you can throw a ball in the courtyard.
What?
Yeah. The story behind this is, it's an official story that 3 years ago Rabbi Weiss came and spent time with the whole group, and we had a great conversation, and everyone, you know, and it was amazing Rabbi Weiss moment. We're off the tape right now, right? I hope so. And he had a, it was an awesome, you know, he's awesome, he was wonderful. And somebody asked, "So what do you guys do for fun?" And everyone just looked back in blankly. This is fun, right? That's what we're learning. And he said, "But like, don't you play ball or something?" No.
So incidentally, we've had often the official Rabbi Weiss fun moment of the day, where he goes out to a courtyard, throws a ball or a frisbee or something, so that we can claim that we've actually done it. We would do it with guest speakers sometimes. Which guest speaker was it?
Question. Question.
Question.
Oh, yeah,
it is
in the hour.
Oh, yeah, good. All right, I'm glad nobody got the
chase,
I don't know. מקובל על יותר ממוסכם. קונצנזוס. לא היה קונצנזוס עכשיו, אלא שלא היה מקלוג על זה כבר ל-20 שנה או כדמי. אוקיי, ואיך עדי?
הייתה קצת עזרה, אבל... אלא יותר קשה ממני, כי אני
חושב פחות מהמסכם. אוקיי. אוקיי.
The first day.
Yeah, so I was going to give a shit. That's it, by the way, I want to catch any issues, really. In terms of...
And Israel is very fun ball. Like, you might call it, this is going to be a discussion
issue. So it's funny that, again, right, the Ketefa Dikon Shibani Lameh, the Vaniha from Tali. ביחס למורים האחרים ואיך שהם שולחים את הפסוקים ללמוד, אז אני מאוד פרונטלי.
אני לא חושב שזה אפשר לפרונטלי?
לא, בשיעורי גמרא הוא אומר שהוא לומד איתנו ושהוא מביא מורה.
אה, אפשר, אבל לא עבר שיעורי גמרא.
אני לא מתאר הרבה שיעורים.
כן, אז היה... There was a fun collection of essays on Talmudic methodology some years ago in which people talked about teachers who claim that they're all about discussion and that they would go watch the class and they would see nothing.
Right.
Interesting. I see myself as the last practitioner of frontal teaching in GAN, so it's fun to be told that I'm not frontal. It's very interesting because in GAN I am the frontal teacher, the one who actually stands in front of the room. GAN Academy. The walk room.
But the main that element is that at least my Gemara Shia, you have a guy sitting there for, you know, 6 years and not know how to learn. He's never put under the pressure to read and analyze text in class.
The Socratic method doesn't necessarily work that way either, because you can cover up, you can call on people only to talk and not to read. There are ways.
Right. I mean, like, the way I've heard that some teachers do it is they will usually, right.
But I prefer being in an environment in which I can call on people.
Right.
I prefer that. I hope it'll work. But sometimes in Dr. Soloveitchik's share, I could not read, because when he called on me, I was so nervous I couldn't read, and my glasses fogged.
You used to give a Gemara Shir?
Three times. I gave a Gemara Shir three times.
And you were in it all three times?
I was in one of them. Okay. My wife picked you up to find everything.
Yes, everything worked out wonderfully. Thanks for being accommodating.
Okay, terrific. We are very glad and flattered that you came back from Morocco to be here.
I'm glad that I caught the first year.
Good. Yeah, I'm glad no one caught that red buzz. That was like, if someone had caught that, I would have had much less to say. I wanted to make sure there was some kind of hop that was.